Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. Today, I'm thrilled to have Sarah Brennus on the show. Sarah is an associate professor of Spanish at Amherst, and she's written an excellent book on a subject I knew before I read the book absolutely nothing about, the experiences and memories of Spanish prisoners in the concentration camp of Mauthausen. And those of you who have listened to the show for a while know I lived in Vienna for a year. That's by train an hour and a half or 2 hours from Vienna. And I never got to Mauthausen. And when I was in Austria, Mauthausen wasn't a thing. That was in the 1990s. And the Austrian experience of remembering Mauthausen has some interesting parallels to the experience that Sarah is going to talk about. But in Spain, the context of that experience, while the memory happens at the same time, the context of that experience is different. And the legacy of the Spanish Civil War, the experience of the Franco government is going to be particularly important. Sarah's book is a careful, thoughtful engagement with the intersection of memory and politics. You can learn a lot about it from that particular case study, but also it says something important about how broadly memory is done. I learned a lot from it. I'm expecting to learn even more from our discussion. So, Sarah, thank you for being with us, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies.
Thanks so much, Kelly. It's great to be here.
So, as we always ask Sarah, ask guests to say something about themselves and how they became interested in their subject. So, can you take a moment and just tell us how you got to be who you are?
I'd be happy to. I began studying Spanish early on. I'm not a native speaker, and I certainly don't have any personal connection to Spain, but I spent a year studying in Madrid when I was an undergraduate at Wesleyan University. And that year was, I would absolutely say, formative. I became very interested in the Spanish Civil War, in the literature and the history of that period, and certainly the Franco dictatorship. And even, you know, the liberties that came with the end of the Franco dictatorship, which I could see very plainly in my host family and the works that I was reading and studying as a student. So I went into graduate school in Hispanic studies, really knowing that I wanted to study the Franco dictatorship, the post-Spanish Civil War period, and the opening of Spain to democracy after Franco's death. It was clear that was sort of my focus, and I was always interested in the history of that period, but I really wanted to focus on literature and film. So, you know, in graduate school, I started reading widely, and just really by chance landed, with the help of my dissertation advisor, on the author Montserrat Roig, who is a female Catalan author, a journalist, who passed away in the 90s. But she wrote a number of novels that treated what at the time was a completely novel idea to me, or novel occurrence, which was the fact that Spaniards had been deported to Nazi concentration camps during World War II. Again, I knew a lot at that point in graduate school, or was learning about Spain and Spain's culture, Spain's history, but this piece was completely unknown to me at the time in graduate school. So I read more, I read Montserrat Roche's sort of canonical work about this period, Catalans in Nazi concentration camps, during graduate school, and the light bulb really went off. I thought, this is a fascinating time period. It brings together a lot of the things that I was already interested in terms of Spain grappling with its legacy of war and its legacy of dictatorship. But it also brought in this new piece that has always also been of interest to me, which is the backdrop of World War II. And really, this project and my interests kind of went from there. I am not a historian, but it was really necessary in graduate school and then in the projects that I've worked on since then, including this book, to delve into historical writing about Spain during World War II, the Franco dictatorship, Franco's relationship with Hitler. And I sort of have started on this path with my first book and now this book of looking at the history of Spain during the interwar period and during, you know, Spanish Civil War, World War II, and the Franco dictatorship, in conjunction with the novels and the films, short stories, memoirs, all kinds of texts and visual texts that have been produced during that period, which kind of lands me in my current interest, which is combining those two fields, fiction and history, broadly speaking, around Spain and its grapplings with its dictatorship and post-dictatorship years.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Many of the people I have on the show are historians or political scientists or sociologists. What is being trained in language studies? What does that bring to your to the way you approach this kind of material?
That's a great question. I think mainly that I'm really open to using other texts as source material for understanding the historical story, you know, the history behind a particular moment. So, you know, I'll give you an example that when I started reading more about this topic about Spaniards in Mauthausen, again, I read Roche's book, which is a collection of oral histories, really testimonies of Spanish Mauthausen survivors. It's an amazing book. It's a moment when she can capture kind of the immediate sentiments of these men and women who survived Nazi concentration camps. But she doesn't bring in any of the stories, any of the fiction, any of the films, any of the other cultural elements that have really contributed to how people in Spain and outside of Spain certainly remember and understand the Spanish experience of Mauthausen and other concentration camps. So my feeling is that, you know, as someone who specializes in cultural studies, in language and in literature, I bring that extra element to the table, not just the history, which is absolutely important and really drives this story and this book, but also these different forms of cultural expression that add to the story, that add these personal nuances to who were these survivors, how did they get to Mauthausen, what did they do after Mauthausen, and sort of above all, how do people today understand or look at these experiences in a concentration camp in Spain and outside of Spain?
So let's turn to the book. But before we get into your specific arguments, I know many of the listeners to the show may not be familiar with the political context. So a couple framing questions. So you mentioned Franco and the Spanish Civil War. Can you give, you're going to love this question. Can you give a maybe 2-minute thumbnail or 3-minute thumbnail description about why Spain descended into civil war and how that ended?
Sure, I'd be happy to. This is a great question too. So Spain had a republic in the 1930s, essentially a representative form of government, the Second Republic. And in the course of the sort of political crises that unfolded during the republic, two factions emerged. And one faction, the nationalists headed by Francisco Franco, rose up in a coup, a military coup against the republic, which then would be called the Republicans, and were plunged into civil war. So the Spanish Civil War began in 1936 with this military coup supported by the Catholic Church and sort of the aristocracy in Spain versus the Republicans, who were still loyal to the government, the representational government, sort of working class, unions, communists, a sort of great amalgam of groups in Spain that made up the Republican Party, the Republican side of the war, that is. The Spanish Civil War lasted for 3 years, ended in 1939. Franco had a superior military strength that meant that the Republicans were almost constantly trying to catch up. And Franco was also supported militarily by Hitler and by Mussolini, so who sent arms, boats, materials, and including some of the Condor Legion, Hitler's Air Force, bombed different cities in Spain during the Spanish Civil War, including Guernica, which is, I'm sure, a place people may recognize from Picasso's famous painting of the bombing of that Basque town. So the Spanish Civil War ended in 1939 with Franco's triumph, and that began a dictatorship that would last almost 40 years. Franco was fascist friendly. He formed his own political movement called the Falange. And during World War II, which is the period that this book covers, Spain never entered the war officially. They were neutral and then non-belligerent. But Franco was in conversation, and his government was in conversation with Hitler throughout the war. They supplied war materials to Germany. There were German nationals in Spain. There was a lot of give and take between Germany and Spain during the war until World War II began to turn toward the Allied forces when Franco began to distance himself and sort of pulled back on Spain's alliance with the unofficial alliance with the Axis. The Franco dictatorship, as I said, lasted until 1975, when Franco died. There was no coup to end the Spanish dictatorship, and during that time, there was a fairly serious censorship and repression of what could be, published in the press and in taught in schools, for instance, including any of the details about Spaniards who were involved in World War II or deported to Nazi concentration camps. I'm not sure if that was 2 minutes, but that's as long as
that was a great answer. And the flip side then from context, as I said, I've never been to Mauthausen. I'm going to guess that many of the listeners have not. Can you say, so it's kind of a two-part thing. Can you talk a little bit about what Mauthausen was and what role it played, but also maybe give us some sense of what Mauthausen looked and looks like and feels like?
Absolutely, yeah. So Mauthausen is located outside of Linz, Austria, a short train ride now away. It's a small town on the Danube River, and the Nazis established one of the first concentration camps there. It's It was and is built almost entirely out of granite. It's got a rock quarry, so it was almost self-contained and built by prisoners who began arriving in 1938 and 1939. The Spanish prisoners began to arrive in 1940, and so were many of the tradesmen who, as slave labor, began to build the camp. It's not an extermination camp, although it did have a gas chamber. It is a concentration camp, but it was notorious as one of the most brutal camps in the Third Reich, in particular because of the slave labor conditions. And we can talk a bit more about the population makeup, but it was particularly heavy on political prisoners, international political prisoners, which is in part why a large contingent of Spanish Republicans ended up at Mauthausen. There were Jews at Mauthausen, but again, they were not the largest population there. So Mauthausen, from its conception to today, has actually... some of the main structures have changed very little. It is now a memorial site called the Mauthausen Memorial. And many of the barracks have disappeared, but many of the primary installations, including the gas chamber, are still there. They were built out of granite to last generations, and indeed they have lasted generations. So now Mauthausen has a rather extensive museum. It is run by the Austrian government, and it hosts yearly commemorations of the liberation of Mauthausen, which happened on or about May 5th, 1945. So every second, I believe it's every second Sunday in May, there are large contingents of international visitors who come to sort of pay homage to people who were killed in Mauthausen. There's a procession. It really draws a huge crowd, and it's broadcast live on Austrian television as well. The procession and the ceremonies that occur there. So I would recommend to anyone in the area a visit. It's a fairly well maintained facility with a lot of information and a lot that honors the very diverse victims of Nazi violence in the camp.
So you touched on this earlier, but now let's come back to it in detail. Say something about the Spanish, I guess citizens is the right word, maybe. Who ended up in Mauthausen? How many were there? Where did they come from? And in particular, you talked about them as Spanish Republicans. Why was that the group that ended up in Mauthausen?
Right. So I'll backtrack a little bit to my historical timeline, because I didn't get into detail in this. But so at the end of the Spanish Civil War, those Spanish citizens, many of whom were Catalan, and Catalonia is the region in the north of Spain, right, bordering France, where Barcelona, the most famous city in Catalonia, is. Mm-hmm. So many of these people who had fought for the Spanish Republic or had otherwise supported the Spanish Republic found themselves really at risk by staying in Spain, a Spain now governed and dominated by Francisco Franco, who had no love lost for his vanquished opponents. So there was a great exodus in 1939 as many Spanish Republicans, their families, women, children, crossed the border into France to escape lingering vengeance, really, in Spain. They were very quickly herded into French internment camps along the southern beaches of France. These were inhospitable places, open to the elements, fleas, dirty, really not a place anyone would want to stay. They were clearly supposed to be transit camps, but the refugees from Spain who had aligned themselves with the Republic didn't feel they could go back. And so many of them were forced or coerced into helping the war effort in France. They were they worked on labor details. Some of them joined the French resistance. Others, were sort of volunteered in quotes along the Maginot Line. And when France fell to the Nazis, they were, for the most part, deported to prisoner of war camps in Germany, Stalags. From there, and now we're talking about a somewhat diminished group because some Spanish citizens were able to move from the French internment camps, escape to the Americas, or hide in France. But for those who were captured as prisoners of war, there was a back and forth between the German government and the Franco government about what to do with these Spaniards. And I'm glad that you brought up the word citizens, because they were, in fact, Spanish citizens, but they were not recognized by the Franco government because they had fought against Franco. And so in the communications between Franco and the Germans at that point, almost by omission, the Germans asked, what should we do with these people? And Franco never responded. And by that omission, he essentially sent them on to concentration camps. There were about 10,000 Spaniards who were deported to different concentration camps, but the majority, about 7,000, were deported to Mauthausen. And as I said earlier, they arrived really at the beginning of the war. 1940 and 1941 was when the most Spaniards arrived at Mauthausen. And many of them, those who survived, only about 60% survived. So a little over 2,000 of those initial 7,000 Spaniards survived Mauthausen. But the ones who did survive were there until the war's end for 5 years in the Mauthausen concentration camp. And at war's end, most of them stayed in France. They were still unwelcome in Franco Spain. They would have still faced reprisals, which would have meant violence or continued incarceration. So most of those who exiled in 1939 never went back.
And so they're political prisoners in Mauthausen. What kind of roles do they fill in that concentration camp?
Right. They're political prisoners who, during the early years, do die in great numbers because of the slave labor conditions. They're working in the quarry, as I mentioned. They're constructing the camp. It's brutal labor. And as in other Nazi concentration camps, the rations are small. They're exposed to the elements. They're forced to do, 12 hours of exterior labor. So many of the Spaniards who die in Mauthausen died in those first 2 years as the camp was being constructed. Those who managed to survive the early brutal conditions oftentimes then were able to find some placement in a privileged position in the camp. And by privileged, I mean they worked inside. They were able to work in the kitchens, in the photography laboratory, with the Gestapo offices. In some cases, because the Spaniards had some linguistic familiarity with German, they had spent time in France and Germany, they were able to speak the language, they were able to position themselves in more protected spots in the camp, which certainly contributed to their survival after 1941. Other Spaniards became capos. So those would be people who were essentially prisoner guards. And there's a lot of controversy over how those prisoner guards, the prisoner capos, treated their fellow citizens, their fellow Spaniards and Catalans. Some were kind, some were cruel. And so this relates to sort of one of the overarching questions of the Holocaust about perpetrators and bystanders and victims. But Spaniards made up really a cross section of the camp between those who really suffered the worst of the conditions and were killed essentially, and those who were able to position themselves and protect themselves and survive the 5 years in the camp.
I was really, excuse me, as I was reading your book, I was really struck by the ability of at least some Spaniards in Mauthausen to record their experience and keep records of the camp while they were actually serving in these roles as functionaries. Can you say a little bit about how that worked and what we know about the camp from people who recorded it while it was active?
Sure. It's a fascinating part of the story. So there were two men in particular who ended up working in the Gestapo offices, named Juan de Diego and Casimir Clement. And these two men were functionaries. They were essentially scribes, writing down, keeping lists of prisoners as they entered the camp with identifying details. But because they spoke Catalan in particular and Spanish, and Juan de Diego had also learned German while he was in the Stalag, I believe Casimir Clement also knew German. Mm. Because of these linguistic abilities, the SS put them in charge of recording the Spaniards in the camp. And so very quickly they became able to collect maybe even more identifying information about their countrymen and at the same time keep duplicate lists. Mm-hmm. The duplicate lists become very important at the end of the war because most of the information that we have coming out of Mauthausen and certainly out of other camps as well is lost, burned, destroyed as the Allies approach at the end of the war. So the fact that these two individuals were clandestinely keeping duplicate records of their countrymen entering the camp means that Mauthausen, after World War II, boasted some of the best records of the victims of any of the Nazi concentration camps in the post-war period. So on the one hand, we have Clement and De Diego. On the other hand, we have a figure who has since become almost heroic in the Spanish imagination, and that's Francesc Boix. He was a member of the Communist Party who managed to get a position, an assignment in the photography laboratory alongside two other Spaniards, Bisbal and Garcia. And these three men in the photography laboratory were tasked with printing photographs, and quickly after their assignment, they started keeping duplicate photographs. So the photography lab would take pictures anytime a Nazi official came to visit. Himmler, Speer would come to visit the camp. They'd also take pictures of bodies of people who had electrocuted themselves on the fence or had been shot. And they also documented SS official portraits. So Boix and these other two men really risked their lives in keeping duplicate copies and duplicate negatives of the photography that came out of the Mauthausen camp. They spirited these negatives away. They spirited the negatives away outside of the camp. They hid them with a woman who was friendly with the French resistance and managed to keep this photographic record until the end of the war. Again, saving it from the pyres that the SS were ordered to burn at the end of the war. And those photographs, some of which I was able to reproduce in this book, have become kind of the visual record of Mauthausen and are some of the most complete visual records that we have of any Nazi concentration camp due to, you know, the privileged position of the Spaniards and their risk-taking in saving these records.
Yeah, there's that group, and I was fascinated by them. And then at the other end of the kind of, I don't know, officialdom spectrum, that's a bad way to put it, but are the people who managed to draw pictures, right, send postcards, I believe, which I found astonishing. Right. And in some way, this is what I found really telling, is that at least a few of them, you cite, drew pictures for the guards, which
that's right,
I was astonished by.
Right. So again, the Spaniards were able to get these positions of relative privilege, and some of them were assigned to the drafting offices, which meant that they had access to pencils and paper, and in some cases even charcoal drawing materials. They drew little cartoons, sort of for the barracks, for their fellow prisoners. They also drew maps of the camp for the clandestine political organization in Mauthausen. But part of why they were able to make these other drawings and keep these materials was that the SS asked them to draw pornographic drawings. Mm. And so there are some survivors who write later about having really crediting their survival to having been a good enough draftsman or a good enough artist to draw pornographic images for the SS, who then looked the other way when they used their materials to draw other drawings, some of which were, you know, maybe to entertain or to sort of make it through their experience, but others were actually fairly important in terms of the prisoners resisting some of the treatment in the camp and trying to help their fellow prisoners survive the camp.
So we know that for prisoners of all nationalities, there's some group of them who immediately or shortly after liberation start to put pen to paper and record their experiences. What does that look like for the Spanish prisoners? How many people began shortly after liberation or in the year or two after liberation to record their experiences? And how many of them were able to get those published? And what did that look like?
So very few put pen to paper, and even fewer were managed to publish what they wrote. There are just a handful of Spanish Mauthausen survivors who began to write after the camp for all the reasons that it's difficult for any concentration camp survivor to write. The immediacy of these memories, these horrible memories, it's difficult to write about them. But there are a couple of survivors who quickly start to write. And one of them actually will end up publishing really the first Nazi concentration camp memoir in Spain in 1946, which when I discovered it, I was astonished by how early this memoir was published. It was by Carlos Rodriguez de Risco, who was a Spanish Republican when he entered Mauthausen and managed to return to Spain after his survival, after the liberation, and began publishing these serialized articles in one of the Franco regime's official newspapers, Arriba, 29 installments that really was his memoir of his experiences in Mauthausen. And when you ask what it looks like, this memoir in particular is really interesting because either in order to publish in the Franco regime newspaper or because Rodriguez de Risco had a political conversion while he was in Mauthausen, we're not sure why, but his articles, while they are historically accurate, they describe details in Mauthausen that it would take decades to really emerge in historical scholarship on the camp. He's also anti-Semitic. He's also an apologist for Hitler and for Franco. There are aspects of his narrative that really veer toward Holocaust denial, blaming the victims for the Nazi crimes. So that's one example. And as I said, it's contentious, but fascinating. Another example is a man of the name of Joaquim Amat Piniella, who began writing about his experience. He was a Catalan survivor of the camp very quickly after he was liberated. And he did not return to Spain. He went to Andorra, the small country between Spain and France, for a period of recuperation. He began writing a novel called Kehl Reich. He published some short excerpts of the novel in very small literary magazines in Spain things that would not trip the censors. But he worked on a sort of novelistic representation of his experience in the camp for years and tried to publish it in Spain. He wrote it in 1946, 47, 48, but he wasn't able to publish it in Spain until quite advanced into the Franco dictatorship, when the censorship had lightened somewhat in 1963. So those two people, those two survivors, are really the ones who put pen to paper, and in very diverse ways. You know, a novel, the novel doesn't even actually mention the name of Mauthausen, but given that the author was a survivor of Mauthausen, there's a great deal of identifying information in K.L. Reich. And the serialized articles, as I said, which are on the other side of the gamut, given their contention as borderline Holocaust denial.
And then there's not much. And there's not much for a couple decades until you get, and this is my characterization, correct me if I'm misreading you, a brief, intense but brief engagement with the Holocaust toward the end of the Franco regime. Well, why does it take so long? And what was this brief engagement like, and why was it so brief?
Yeah, it's fascinating. There are these few things that emerge in the 40s, almost nothing in the 50s, a couple more things in the 60s. So a period of silence that's directly the result of the Franco dictatorship, that the survivors of Mauthausen, if they were writing, were writing in France. They had almost no chance of publishing anything in Spain, again, with the exception of Amat Piniella's novel in the 60s. And I think there was a sense of frustration, and there was a sense of risk that trying to publish your experience of a Nazi concentration camp when you are persona non grata in Spain under the Franco dictatorship simply was too, it was too great a risk for life and for one's family. So in the 1970s, Franco is on his deathbed, and there's a beginning of a movement to kind of shed some light on this period. People are interested. And this takes us back to the book I read in graduate school by Montserrat Roche, who began interviewing survivors. She had to travel to France for the most part, to interview them, because she was still working under the Franco regime. And she, again, did not want to risk her own livelihood to cover this story. But she began telling stories about the Mauthausen survivors in the Spanish press, and then published her compendium of oral testimony. And that really cracked things open for a while. The late 70s, a number of other survivors, Mariano Constante is probably the most well-known, published memoirs, appeared on Spanish television. There were interviews, broadcasts across the nation in Spain with survivors. And there was this resurgence in interest in the late 70s. And by the late 70s, Franco had died, and there was a movement toward democracy. There was a feeling that, you know, more could be said in the country, more could be reckoned with about Spain's past. People could sort of confront those issues. But then it stopped again in the early 80s. And my argument is that there was another attempted military coup in 1982, failed, but that put the fear of God back into these Mauthausen survivors who had started to tell their stories, but then felt again that specter of Franco and thought better of trying to sort of broach the topic in Spain. And so come 1981, 1982, the topic disappears again. And we see almost nothing then until the late 90s, when things, survivors, I think, begin to feel this sense that of urgency to tell their stories. They're by now elderly men and women, and we have a new crop of life stories and survivor memoirs that come out at the end of the 20th century.
Yeah, I was really as I was reading, you did a wonderful job, kind of distilling that new memoir literature into a kind of pattern or template. So what did all of those, what kind of template did all of those or many of those memoirs fit into or utilize as they're telling their stories? What do those life stories look like?
First and foremost, they're incredibly difficult to find because they were all published by regional publishing houses. Many of them were associated with, you know, a regional government or a cultural institution. And when I say regional, I mean, you know, small regions in Spain, not nationwide, things that would not have landed at anyone's local bookstore that were probably had print runs of maybe 500 and were, you know, passed around to friends and relations and adopted into the archives of the Spain's National Library, which is where I found them. Hmm. But they're all very personal memoirs that take one person's experience from, they almost all begin with the exodus that I described earlier, leaving Spain, the time in the French internment camps, the deportation to the prisoner of war camps, and then really focus on those 4 or 5 years in Mauthausen. And every memoir is slightly different because everyone's experience is slightly different, but they all hew to a pretty standard chronology. They all mention specific events that happened in Mauthausen that everyone would have been aware of had they not seen things like sort of spectacles of prisoner executions or the spiriting away of the photographs, which became really notorious among Spanish Mauthausen survivors. Other specific events that had to do with how the war was progressing, the news that would filter to the prisoners in the camp. So all of these memoirs touch on some of that historical timeline and some of those sort of more notorious events that happened in Mauthausen. But they also discuss, you know, the own survivors' feelings, their particular suffering that they had in the camp. Everyone had a different role. Some, as I had mentioned before, were really slave laborers their entire time. Others had privileged positions in different physical places in the camp, and so were able to see different things. Some prisoners were able to witness not actual executions of Jews, but they did see groups of Jewish prisoners coming into the camp and then would see that they were no longer in the camp the next day, for instance, and drew the logical conclusion that they had all been killed. Others, you know, describe smelling the smoke from the crematory smokestacks. They have these very central is a word to describe it, ways of describing what they felt and saw and smelled in the camps that you really can't get, in my estimation, from other historical works on Mauthausen. They're very personal. And in an even more personal sense, they describe what happened to these survivors after they were liberated from the camp and the difficulties they had reintegrating into society, finding work, having to stay out of Spain, away from their families because of the threats of violence and returning. And almost to a piece, each of these books also discuss how difficult it is to tell this story and how difficult it has been to manage Spain's, you know, almost complete silence on the topic of Spaniards who were deported to Nazi concentration camps. They're all the survivors who wrote in the 90s and the early 2000s feel this urgency that they can finally tell their story and that they need to tell their story, because if they don't, the Spanish public won't know it in any other way.
Yeah. So a couple follow-ups on that one. One is, I'd never heard of these. I teach the Holocaust. I'm not trained specifically in the Holocaust. I'm trained more broadly, but I teach the Holocaust. I'd never heard of any of these memoirs. To what degree, if any, are the memoirs you read integrated into the broader consciousness of people across the globe, but especially in Europe and America, who read and think about the Holocaust? Does anybody read these?
I mean, the short answer is no.
Yeah.
They're not integrated in any way, shape, or form. They're entirely written in Spanish and Catalan. Mm-hmm. I don't know of any that have been translated mm-hmm. into English. They may be known, and some specific survivors may be known to their region in Spain. They were known to the survivor organizations in Spain. The Amical de Mauthausen is sort of one of the major groups that organize education and different trips to Mauthausen to sort of bring these people and their experiences to light. But in terms of entering the larger conversation about the Holocaust, there's very little possibility for that. These memoirs in particular are really restricted to Spain because of the language they're published mm-hmm. in. And they're also, I mean, they're idiosyncratic in the sense that these are not professional writers yeah. who have written these memoirs. You know, you read other great works of Holocaust literature, Knight, mm-hmm. Elie Wiesel, or, you know, Primo Levi. They don't read like that. They're not works of great literature. What they are very immediate, you know, the sense of a survivor's memoirs in that sense of immediate personal stories. But I think because of these different issues, they really haven't found an audience outside of Spain and to a great extent have found very little audience inside of Spain as well.
Yeah. So let me flip the follow-up around then again and say, are these authors reading as they are formulating their memoirs, as they're thinking about how to write a memoir about their experience, have they been reading the kind of in the canon of Holocaust memoirs? Do they have a template for themselves, do you think, in their own mind before they start? Or is this a parallel development that's not really connected with other kinds of Holocaust literature?
I think they're examples of both of those, both using a model of Holocaust literature and not. What's interesting about looking at the chronology that I'm looking at in the book is that obviously someone who writes their memoir in 1946 yeah. or 1947 is going to have a vastly different exposure than someone who's writing their memoir in 1996 or 1997. So the survivors who are writing in the 90s and the 2000s, if they haven't read widely, they have read. They have read Holocaust memoirs. They have read, they've certainly read historical material about Mauthausen. Mm-hmm. And you can tell because they do reference things that they wouldn't have been able to see. They reference sort of the overarching history of World War II. And some of them make mention of Primo Levi or of Jorge Semprún, who's a Spanish national who is certainly Spain's most well-known Holocaust survivor, who published most of his work in French. But there are then others who have clearly not read sort of the canon or any piece of the canon of Holocaust literature. And for those people, these are their own. It's almost as though they're writing for their family. They're writing their memories so that they're recorded and so that people who are close to them will know what they went through. But they don't when you read them, you don't feel the sense that they're trying to write into the canon, for instance. They're simply trying to have something to leave behind so that people know this history.
Yeah, I want to get back to that question of personal and national memory in a second, but you do point out in your book that as this resurgence of interest emerges, one of the things that happens is a broader variety of forms of representation and memory, and you talk about fiction and film and graphic novels. So maybe you could say just a little bit about the other. Expand on that, about the other forms of representation that survivors and people who are interested in their experience use.
Sure, absolutely. And this is where the story of the Spaniards in Mauthausen does track to a great extent with what's going on in Holocaust studies. You know, as these survivors are lost, and at this point, I can't give you an exact number, but there are single digits of Holocaust, Mauthausen survivors in Spain now. As the survivors themselves can no longer tell their stories. What's happened in Spain is that they're being told by if not family members, then interested others who are interested in telling the story of the Spaniards in Mauthausen. And that form has sort of morphed or transformed into new ways to tell the story, not simply memoir, but novels, fiction, graphic novels, as you mentioned, documentary films, and there's even on the horizon a fictional film about Mauthausen that's about to come out, down to a Twitter account, a Twitter narrative that someone's put together based on his uncle's experience in Mauthausen. And these run the gamut of sort of quality and maybe fidelity to the story of the Spaniards in Mauthausen. Some, like the graphic novel I'm thinking of, are somewhat sensationalized and end up dehistoricizing the story of the Spaniards in Mauthausen, end up using information that's really not accurate in the interest of a good story. But others, and I'm thinking of a play called The Blue Triangle that came out a couple years ago in Spain, do try to work with the historical material, try to work with the survivor memoirs to represent with more accuracy or at least with more understanding the experiences that the Spaniards in Mauthausen had. But it's amazing what's happened in the last decade. Really, there's been from that silence that we saw in the early 90s to this explosion of, you know, blockbuster novels. There are a couple of novels that have gone through multiple editions based on the Spaniards in Mauthausen. And then again, through interesting new media explorations like a Twitter account.
So back to that question about identity and memory, which maybe I'll get into by pointing out that you cite in the book, I think it's Paul Preston, I think that's his name, as one of a number of people who use the term Holocaust to refer to events that are distinctive to Spain. So how do Spanish or writers in the Spanish Peninsula think about this idea of the Holocaust? And how is that, or a Holocaust, or of Holocausts, and how has the writing you studied shaped that?
So this is a tricky question, because in Spain you have to separate scholars from the general public. Mm-hmm. The general public in Spain, I'm including some usage, like you mentioned, Paul Preston has a book called The Spanish Holocaust, mm-hmm. which doesn't have anything to do with the Holocaust. It has to do with the Spanish Civil War. So in Spain, there's a tendency to use that term Holocaust very widely, and in a way that could be quite polemical to people who study the Holocaust as the extermination of European Jewry. Using the Holocaust as a term to signify, you know, the massacres that happened in the Spanish Civil War or the incarceration of Francoist detractors in the early years of the dictatorship. And then on the other hand, there are those who understand the Holocaust to mean anyone who was victimized by the Nazis in Nazi concentration camps and during World War II. Which outside of Spain is really not, we understand the Holocaust to be the extermination of Jews. Scholars in Spain are a bit more attuned to what the conversation is outside of the peninsula and are certainly careful to distinguish Nazi victims who are not Jewish from Jewish victims of the Nazis. But it's difficult in the public conversation, and which we see in the newspapers and on television, there is a sense that these Spanish Mauthausen survivors are, quote, victims of the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. And outside of Spain, that reading is simply not really acceptable in Holocaust studies. They are victims of the Nazis, but they're non-Jewish victims. They were not subject to extermination in the gas chambers. So, you know, this is part of kind of the sticky part of trying to tell this story, is because certainly there's an absolute need to understand the legacy of Spaniards who were victimized by the Nazis, of the Spanish involvement in World War II. But there's also a need to understand that it was different than the Jewish experience of the Holocaust. And that's a work in progress in Spain. And some of the newer representations that move beyond survivor memoirs do at times cross those lines into kind of the non-specific usage of the word Holocaust in a way that can be problematic.
So that seems like an appropriate place to end. We've taken a lot of your time. But I always ask guests the same two questions at the end. And the first is, it's as we're taping this, while your semester hasn't quite started, mine has, but I'm looking forward to an almost immediate holiday break with Labor Day weekend. And rather than prepare lectures or grade, I would really rather read something interesting. So maybe you could suggest to listeners a book or two, or maybe it's a movie, something that was meaningful for you as you were writing this book that we should go off and read or watch.
Sure. That's an interesting question. I have two recommendations that I'll give that I think would be both enjoyable and really enlightening. And they're kind of the two bookends of this project. So the first one is the novel I mentioned, Kale Reich by Joaquim Amat Piniella, which was written in the 40s, published in the 60s, but has been recently and quite nicely translated into English. So would be very accessible for your listeners. It was published in an English edition in 2014. And again, a really sensitive portrayal of the Spanish experience that kind of opens up into all different strata in the Mauthausen concentration camp. Germans, Spaniards, other political prisoners, told through the voice of a narrator who really is a foil for the author himself, who, as I said, was a Mauthausen survivor from Catalonia. That on the one hand, I think Kale Reich is a novel that really is worth teaching, worth reading, worth thinking about. It should be canonical outside of Spain, but it's not yet. And the second recommendation I would have is the Twitter account, actually, that I mentioned. I think in terms of understanding kind of the new directions that Spanish representations of the Nazi camps are taking, and even of the Holocaust in general, it's worth looking at this particular Twitter account. So it's called Deportado 4443. And it is written in Spanish, but Twitter has a nice algorithm that translates and it does a pretty accurate job of translating these tweets. And just in short, it's a Twitter account that essentially, to commemorate the 70th anniversary of the liberation of Mauthausen, distilled 5 years in a prisoner's life in the camp into 3 months worth of tweets. So 3 months worth of short entries, almost diary-like entries that are apocryphal. No one ever actually wrote these. They're based on the Twitter author's uncle's experience in Mauthausen. And the author himself, Carlos Hernández de Miguel, is a Spanish journalist. But they use the apparatus of Twitter. So they use links to photos and short films, often provided by the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. They use hashtags, uses replies, and this Twitter account, Deportado 4443, has really become sort of a conversation about the Spanish legacy of the Holocaust and Mauthausen, how it's remembered, how it should be remembered, and almost to the point of being an advocate for keeping the Spanish presence in Mauthausen alive in our memories. So I think your listeners would also enjoy, and certainly in terms of speed on a holiday weekend, it's not a hard read to look through the Twitter account.
Well, I have to say, you've just gotten me in trouble with my family, because I'm now going to be spending Monday afternoon looking at Twitter rather than playing softball with my daughter. But I will blame you and all will be well. So, thank you so much for your time. This is a fascinating discussion. It's a wonderful book. We're only able to touch the highlights, and I encourage people to go out and read it. What are you working on next?
Well, as we speak, I'm putting the finishing touches on a manuscript, an edited volume with my colleague, Gina Herman at the University of Oregon. We're working on a book entitled Spain, World War II and the Holocaust, History and Representation. It has 30-odd scholarly essays about the full gamut of Spain's relationship to World War II and the Holocaust, as the title indicates, including historians, sociologists, literary scholars, cultural scholars. It's going to be a fascinating book, and we're really excited. It'll be coming out with the University of Toronto soon, hopefully.
Well, wonderful. Well, congratulations. And I hope that when it does come out, you'll be willing to come back on the show and talk about it with the audience again. So until that happens, thank you so much, and have a great beginning to your semester.
Thanks so much, Kelly. It was a pleasure.
All right. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Sarah Brennis about her book, Spaniards in Mauthausen, Representations of a Nazi Concentration Camp. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or Stitcher or other podcast providers, or from the webpage from New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I hope you'll join me next time when I'll talk with Roz Segal about his new book, Genocide in the Carpathians, War, Social Breakdown, and Mass Violence, 1914 to 1945. Until then, thanks for the download and have a great month.